Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to a Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and these days more than daily politics podcast. So what is the issue that will decide the election? The Tories want to make it about Brexit. Labour's rather keen to talk about the NHS. But there's one issue that has been rising in importance to voters over the past couple of years, and that is the environment. YouGov say that in the most recent poll they did on this, 27% of voters cited the environment as one of the three top issues behind Brexit and health. Both main parties, as well as the Liberal Democrats and Greens, have environment policies that they are keen to push. So to work out who has the best plan and who's putting it at the top of their agenda, I am joined by Grace Blakely, the author of Stolen, How to Save the World from Financialisation, and Ryan Shorthouse, the director of Bright Blue. Ryan, Bright Blue, when it comes to, and I know you're not a party-specific think tank, but when it comes to think tanks that are seen to, I suppose, have conversations with Conservatives, you've been ahead, I think, in identifying the environment as an issue that is of a concern to many voters, particularly young voters. Have you seen over the past couple of years governments and major parties taking more of an interest in it as an electoral issue?
Definitely, yes. I mean, we did a poll of younger adults just after the 2017 election. Of course, the big thing there was younger people disproportionately voted for Labour. And younger people, by the way, the bracket, thankfully, was under 40. And we asked them, you know, what the top issue was: Brexit, NHS, crime, and the environment was the thing that they wanted politicians to speak more about and do more on. And as you said in your introduction, across the board, but particularly amongst young people, it's raised in prominence. And interestingly, there was a poll the other week which suggested that the Conservatives are ahead of Labour in public attitudes on the environment and the party doing more on environmental matters. And you've seen, for example, Boris this week talking about new policies, the kind of clean energy revolution, more investment for electric vehicle charging infrastructure, more investment for offshore wind. There's much more to do, and we'll probably get onto that. But it is definitely something which is central to the Conservative campaign. And I think it's important because, you know, the Conservatives are very conscious that they are appealing to types of voters, more working class voters in Northern England and Northern Wales. But they're a bit concerned that that kind of hardline approach on Brexit may be putting off younger people in liberal, more urban areas. And actually, the environment is a key issue for those types of voters. So I think that's going to be part of their armoury during the election and certainly in the manifesto.
Grace, I remember in the aftermath of the 2017 general election, Tory MPs being summoned to Downing Street for a presentation, and they were told about various values voters had and how Labour led on the NHS. But one area where it was neutral and no party yet led was actually the environment. And this meant there was an opportunity because Labour weren't leading there. Do you think in the past couple of years, and particularly under Jeremy Corbyn, the environment has arisen as an issue that the party is focusing on?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the main reason for this has been the way that the membership feels about the environment. Obviously, we've seen a kind of increase in member-led policymaking this year at conference. There are a bunch of different campaigns, including a campaign led by Labour for a Green New Deal, seeking to kind of mobilise members to submit motions to conference to get those put in the manifesto. And one of those, as I said, that passed was this motion by Labour for a Green New Deal, seeking to get the party to commit to decarbonising by 2030, which is one of the most ambitious targets in the world, and to do so by through this idea of the kind of Green New Deal, which is becoming kind of increasingly popular on both sides of the Atlantic as kind of left and mainly socialist politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jeremy Corbyn in the UK speak favourably of these kinds of policies. And there was some polling that came out last week by Client Earth with Opinium that showed that 63% of people were in favour of this idea of the Green New Deal. which was phrased as large-scale long-term investment in green jobs and infrastructure. And yeah, I think, you know, as you can see from last week's Warm Homes for All plan, that's both aimed at kind of, you know, reducing emissions and creating jobs, Labour is developing a quite unique approach to this that combines, you know, previous commitments on investment and job creation with improving sustainability.
And on that, Grace, just quickly, we know the current target for net emissions is 2050 under this government.
Yeah.
We have the Clause 5 meeting this weekend with Labour in terms of the manifesto. At conference, there was that vote, as you mentioned. What do you think in terms of the long-term end date the Labour leadership should be going for on this and are likely to?
I think it's really important that the leadership goes for a 2030 date. And the reason for that is that, so globally, we have to halve our emissions as a planet by 2050 if we are to avert complete climate catastrophe. Like science fiction kind of stuff would be happening if we didn't manage to do that, because we'd be, you know, on current trajectories, obviously aiming for kind of 4 degrees warming, which yeah would create this kind of hot house earth scenario that would see, you know, food systems break down, ecological systems break down, rising sea levels, desertification, etc. You start to break a load of different kind of feedback loops in the environment that leads to like really chaotic events. So it's really important that we do that as a globe by 2050. But the UK in particular has a really significant responsibility to have an earlier date, because historically, I mean, currently we're not one of the biggest emitters, but if you look at the kind of history of carbon emissions and take into account all historic emissions, we're the fifth largest. And of course, you know, being able to industrialize in an age where these issues weren't known about has made us a very rich country today and has allowed us to decarbonize now and offshore quite a lot of our emissions by offshoring production. So it's really important that countries like the UK that have already industrialized and have already emitted quite a lot have an earlier date for decarbonization, so that countries that have yet to industrialize have a little bit more leeway in being able to do that.
And Ryan, when it comes to, I suppose, voter appetite for environmental policies, we've seen Extinction Rebellion, not necessarily that everyone who cares about the environment go on that march, but it did at times have public sympathy, perhaps particularly when they weren't stopping tubes. But in general, it does feel as though there is some warmth towards that cause because people want to prevent climate change and work on the environment. Yet, if you go for carbon emissions targets such as 2030, some talk about even 2025, lots of the environmental study groups suggest that they would take quite radical change to your everyday life in terms of limited flights potentially per year, also looking at cutting out meat or seriously rationing meat. And the other thing is how you heat your home, the idea that you would actually have to replace a boiler system, which would be very expensive. Now, Labour have gone some way with some of the things this week on, you know, double glazing windows, all these offers to do that. But do you think that the radical changes you might need for a target like that is where the public currently are? Or do you think that we're more at the place where we say we don't like single-use plastics and we're not going to drink our cocktails with a straw?
Yeah, and I think we need to be very careful about this because, as Grace has said, you know, the science is very strong and conservatives can be very sceptical of kind of scaremongering about various different trends. But the science is very strong on climate change, that, you know, action is required. The kind of knock-on effect of the Paris Agreement is that you can get the net zero emissions by 2050. That's what the CCC say, that you need, the Committee on Climate Change, the independent body, says that you need a net zero target to be compliant with the Paris Agreement. And then on top of that, they think it's not feasible in terms of achieving that decarbonisation earlier than 2050. And I do worry slightly that the kind of more radical approach of 2025, 2030 for net zero will not carry the public along with them. It will require, as you say, quite deep changes to people's lifestyles, to people's homes, in a way which I think could antagonise the public. And for example, you look at the rise in the wage floor, the minimum wage. I think it's very important that that is underpinned by a good, strong evidence base. Because if you go too far and you raise the wage floor by too much that it starts to lead to a loss in jobs, I think there will be a backlash against raising the wage floor. And the thing about the minimum wage is you've got that cross-party consensus because it's been backed up by evidence, particularly from the Low Pay Commission. And I think we need to do the same with climate change, that it needs to be underpinned by the evidence from the Committee of Climate Change to keep the public on board. And I think that's really important.
And on that, Grace, the Labour Party isn't completely united on this topic. So if you look at Labour conference when there was a vote on net zero carbon emissions by 2030, you had some of the trade unions refusing to sign up. GMB, which represents workers across industrial sectors, included in that. And there is a concern about what it might mean to jobs, to employment. Do you think there's a risk that by Labour, I suppose, pitching itself as the most radical main party on the environment, you scare off some more traditional voters?
Not really. I mean, I think the way in which the conference motion played out was there were one or two unions that were holding out for a later target, and also were holding out to do with particular things that were included in the motion, so things around fracking, for example. But, you know, ultimately, through the kind of grassroots lobbying effort that was organised by Labour for a Green New Deal, and through a kind of compromise, they agreed to come on board with that motion. And so now, we know we're in a situation where all of the membership and all of the trade unions are on board with this. So, I mean, it would be surprising if that suddenly fell apart and we ended up going back to the drawing board with a 2050 target. I think when you look at the IPCC discussion of kind of feasibility, then, you know, it is very much based upon the assumption that the kind of big, large scale changes that we've seen historically when the government commits to big programs of investment won't happen. The whole idea of the Green New Deal is that you transform the calculation of feasibility by channeling a huge amount of investment into green technology, green infrastructure, you know, research, the energy system, etc.
Where I think there may be a dividing line between the Tories and Labour on this environmental issue is, one is when the net zero target date is. And I think, you know, Conservatives will be keen to say, yes, we need to do the environmental stuff, but do it sensibly, whereas Labour's more advanced date is more radical and they'll want to distinguish that way. I think the other thing is the role of markets and the role of state in achieving deeper decarbonisation. I mean, it used to be assumed for a long time that as you had economic growth, you would have emissions growth as well. But that's now, particularly in this country and other developed countries, been decoupled, that you can have economic growth and you can have decarbonisation and a reduction in emissions. And frankly, some of the changes that we'll need, particularly in the energy network, but also in the transport sector as well, will require substantial investment. And Boris has announced new investment over the past week, but that's really much more is needed. But it's not only public investment, it's also private investment. So I do worry with some of Labour's plans, particularly around the kind of nationalisation of energy companies, that you will be missing out on the private investment that is needed to change a lot of the infrastructure that we have. And also, you know, you may be missing out on some of the growth, the green growth that comes from this agenda, the jobs that's created, the investment, London as the kind of green finance capital. If you nationalise and you move away from a market-based system, I do worry that you miss out on the private investment and the benefit that can accrue from that.
So the first point, actually, the point about the decoupling of emissions and GDP, it speaks to my earlier point, because the reason that we've been able to do this is because of offshoring a huge amount of dirty production to other parts of the world that are then responsible for that and have to account for those emissions in their calculations. So, you know, the decoupling effect in many ways imposes upon us a quicker target. When it comes to the role of markets, I mean, this is obviously, you know, the big point of disagreement on the environment between the left and the right. And I think, you know, those on the left, when looking at this issue, it's very clear that, you know, the incentives that currently exist are not there to facilitate the kind of transition that we would need on the timescale that we need, relying just on markets. And then there's a question about, okay, so what role should the state play in trying to transform those incentives, or kind of, you know, do the shifting of production itself? And so far, we've had this idea that that states and international institutions can, say, impose small carbon taxes, have mechanisms for carbon pricing, impose regulation, do things like green finance, where we've seen, the imposition of the environmental and sustainability goals, or our attempt to kind of shift investment towards more environmentally sustainable corporations. But none of that, and this has, you know, been happening over several decades now, none of that has delivered the shift that we need on the timescale that we need. And in fact, when you look at the levels of investment in fossil fuel companies, and by the way, the banks that lend to those fossil fuel companies, because it's another significant issue that isn't accounted for when it comes to green finance, you know, there is still a massive carbon bubble in that industry, in the sense that if we were properly accounting for the way in which these companies would need to decarbonize, then their stock market valuations would be much lower. So, you know, green finance is not yet proving itself to be what kind of some of its proponents would have hoped it to be. I think it's clear when you look, you know, historically at transitions like this, where they have occurred, they've always occurred because the state has stepped in and decided, right, we are going to do this thing. And it has therefore crowded in a huge amount of private investment. Obviously, when the state says we are going to invest huge amounts in X, Y, and Z, that in many ways de-risks the investment that the private sector might want to undertake, but doesn't, which, you know, means that in many ways it makes that process much more efficient.
No, I mean, I wouldn't completely agree with that. I think, you know, it's not about leaving markets alone. There is a role for public policy and government. But if you look at the power sector, for example, in recent decades, a market-led system there has been quite deep decarbonisation. Renewable energy is taking up a lot more of the UK's energy grid. It's, you know, one of the cheapest forms of energy production that we have. Obviously, government has played a role there in terms of regulation and incentives, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, that has happened with a market-led system, not a nationalised one. You know, there are other sectors of the economy, like the building sector, for example, and also agriculture, where, you know, we need, and transport, where we need much more deeper decarbonisation, and the government will have to do more things. So, for example, I quite like the Labour idea around interest-free loans for home energy improvement. And since the Green Deal was scrapped earlier in this decade, there's been a lack of policy incentives around there. So the government really has to step it up. And on transport as well, it's right that the government has a target to phase out new petrol and diesel cars by 2040. But really, to really give electrification a real nudge, green number plates, which is a nice idea, isn't enough. We also need some fiscal incentives, like removing VAT, for example, which we'll be able to do once we come out of the EU. The government should use that sort of thing to really accelerate. So it's a market-led system with sensible government incentives and policy.
Now, bringing this back to the election, how both main parties should be pitching themselves. Ryan, just before I ask you both a final question, one thing I was interested in is, if you look at, I suppose, the green movement in terms of those who turn up on Extinction Rebellion protests, and obviously it does go beyond that, the Conservatives have long had a reputation for being environmental in some circles. You have Margaret Thatcher, the first leader of a major economy to accept that global warming was a real threat. But it doesn't feel as though the Conservatives are often in the conversation when it comes to social media, perhaps it comes to a younger audience. You have Momentum teaming up for Extinction Rebellion. Now, clearly, these are different ways of doing things. But how do you think the Conservatives can stop being frozen out, I suppose, of a conversation where you have lots of younger voters, particularly, who are clearly passionate about a topic, but they're not necessarily connecting that to anything the Tories are doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one. And, you know, interestingly, about green politics over time, you know, there's that whole sort of watermelon thing, which is green on the outside, red in the middle. And actually, I think if you look across a lot of European countries like Germany, the Green Party has moved much more to the centre ground, because it feels that it can work with parties from different parts of the spectrum. And that's really how it gets more influence and cut through. I think with the Conservatives, there is a strain of people on the right who, there is that climate denialism, and there's a feeling that it is, you know, the kind of climate agenda is associated with restricting human freedom and restricting capitalism. And it's very important, I think, for Conservatives to show how capitalism can sit side by side with efforts to decarbonise. and that there are sensible policies that they will have to achieve that. So I think that's the main thing, really. And, you know, as I said, there is polling now which suggests that the Conservatives, in the public's mind, are ahead on the environment compared to Labour. So they are making a difference. And, of course, Boris is somebody, you know, who, yes, takes a very hard line on approach on Brexit, but with the environment, he has, he's obviously his girlfriend, but a lot of his people around him, his main political allies, like the Goldsmiths, for example, are very passionate about this and are using social media, using traditional media much more to show how, you know, conservation is in effect a very conservative thing.
And then final question to both of you. I wondered if you had any ideas in the sense of what do you think a vote winning environmental policy or pledge would be for either of the parties ultimately going into this election as manifestos are currently being drafted. Grace, do you want to go first?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think it has to be structured around this idea of the Green New Deal. And, you know, speaking to Ryan's point about markets and the kind of increase in renewables that we've seen in the UK, a huge amount of that has happened because of the massive falls in costs that we've seen in areas like solar because of the investment that's been undertaken by governments, not our government often, governments like Germany. But again, that has incentivized, the investment that's been put into that has incentivized these kinds of transitions. So there is a need for a kind of a quite significant amount of government intervention in this to correct this complete short-termism on the part of financial markets when it comes to climate change. And that has to come from public investment. This is just, I think, accepted across the spectrum that there needs to be some level of direction from government in order to, yeah, as I said, kind of channel investment into those places and ensure that there are the incentives to decarbonize.
And Ryan, what do you think would be a smart pledge, I suppose, perhaps for the Conservatives to make in this election?
I think a real focus should be around air pollution, because I think that has raised in the public's mind as a serious issue. The evidence base around the harm that it causes to human health and the environment has increased. And so I think two things around that. I think the current limits that we have on air quality concentration, which is derived by from EU law at the moment for different pollutants, I think the UK should be saying we're going to be more ambitious and we're going to subscribe to the World Health Organization proposed limits around different air pollutants. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is air pollution. Obviously, there's things like nitrogen oxide and particulate matter, but there's also the kind of contribution to climate change that air pollution causes as well. So I think, you know, we really need to make much more progress on the transition to kind of electrified vehicles. And the progress on transport and its contribution to climate change has not been good enough in recent decades. So, you know, we need stronger incentives. And for example, I would like to see tax cuts for people basically who are buying electric vehicles by making sure that the VAT that's imposed on electric vehicles is 0%.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Grace.